With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. The 2023 America's Farmers Market Celebration and Competition is happening now. Right now, American Farmland Trust and the Farmers Market Coalition are giving away $15,000 in prizes to the nation's favorite farmers markets. Voting started last month and it runs through September 18th. You can head on over to markets.farmland.org to enter in your zip code in the search link to vote for your favorite farmers market. You can also search the site for resources, how you can support farmers markets, including getting a free No Farm, No Food bumper sticker, as well as just stay connected with local farmers in your area. Again, to learn more, visit markets.farmland.org. And now let's get into today's show headlines. Prop 12 and its slippery slope. California extended the window for producers to comply with Prop 12. That means Congress has 6 more months to work on a solution. Iowa Secretary Mike Nagg weighed in, saying if unchecked by Congress, this means that 50 states could have 50 set of compliance rules, and that could spell disaster for any industry. It also means huge financial burdens for producers.
If you look at that Supreme Court decision broadly, what it basically says is, as long as you impose the same restrictions on the producers or the manufacturers of something in your own state, you can then impose those preferences or those restrictions on folks outside of your state that want to market in. And so it's not just pork. By the way, this also creates this concept of now you're headed for a patchwork of rules and regulations that how would you ever comply with all of them? And they're ever changing. If each legislative session or each new election cycle, you can put a new ballot initiative up. How in the world could you ever comply? How could you ever secure the capital, the financing that you need in order to comply when all you can say is, hey, I only know that I'm going to be compliant until they change the law next election or next time the legislature's in session. From a practical reality, it's just very, very difficult.
NAFB contributed to that report. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
Farm bill negotiations include conversations about making improvements to disaster programs. Almond Alliance CEO Aubrey Betancourt described some of the shortcomings of the current disaster program structure.
We have an unfortunate reality where our disaster programs are usually a year later and a dollar short. And that is because we have a requirement for ad hoc disaster programs that have to be approved by Congress. Now, I'm not advocating we take that authority away from Congress. However, because they're done ad hoc, you usually have to wait for multiple disasters around the country to add up. And then the USDA, of no fault of their own, has to write a whole new program, design all new software, train all new people. Our farmers have to learn a whole new program, have to then re-enroll. You have to enroll in that program, have to learn that program. And when you consider that we have passed an ad hoc disaster program every year for the last 5 years, I don't think it's ad hoc anymore.
There's been some positive momentum in efforts to help address broom rape issues in processing tomatoes. Managing Director of the California Tomato Research Institute, Zach Bagley, said last year saw some good news for helping mitigate the problem.
One of them was applying for and getting the only 24C, which was pushed through DPR in 2022, was a treatment for broom rape. The idea here is you're in an area where you have a broom rape concern, you can use this treatment in your field, and where we've tested it both in California but also in Chile, about a fourfold decrease in strikes of broom rape. So the potential of new broom rape seeds to be built into your weed bank there. So one win there, one option for growers in the impacted area.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen? I just want to stay informed while I'm on the go.
News on the radio, it's nice because it's just a quick snippet and I don't have to go searching for it or grab a paper.
I listen to radio because anywhere that I'm going, I'm listening to music or I'm listening to a talk show or I'm just trying to stay up on current events.
I always turn into the radio to see if I need to take shelter, where it's hitting, to see what I need to be preparing for.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, the Federal Aviation Administration is making it easier to use drones in farming. Arthur Erickson is the CEO and co-founder of Helio, which designs and sells crop treatment drones. He says the rule change was needed.
Yeah, so essentially the FAA, bless their hearts, right? They're understaffed and overworked. Drones hit the scene very rapidly, right, in the last 5-6 years. And so the FAA didn't have time to come up with regulations specific to drones. So what they did was they took old regulations that are meant for crop dusting airplane pilots and helicopter pilots, and they tried to fit that square peg into the round hole of drones. So what that ended up doing was it created this really long application certification process that drone pilots had to go through, which was to the same level of stringency as these manned aviation pilots had to go through. And that was just a needlessly long and difficult process. So that, from a regulatory perspective, was a barrier to entry for a lot of people trying to get into the spray drone industry. Now the FAA has finally caught up and has reduced a lot of the friction in that process, and they streamlined it just for drone users, which don't need nearly the level of certification that these manned aviation pilots do. So they made the process go from, let's say, about 12 months that certification used to take down to 1 or 2 months.
Erickson says the use of drone technology is becoming more popular in agriculture.
It is, I would say, already being adopted at a very quick rate. There's probably still only, we're talking thousands, not hundreds of thousands of spray drones in the U.S. right now, just because the industry is so new. But people are buying drones every single day. I talk to farmers, well, me myself directly, not so much anymore, but our sales team is talking to 10, 20 people a day, typically inquiring about buying multiple drones for their farm or their spray operation. So it's a very popular topic right now, and I think a lot of people have finally caught the bug, so to speak. They finally realized, hey, these spray drones aren't just a novelty. This is actually something that could enhance my farm. So we're getting a lot of good interest. It wasn't until like a year or two ago that it became this ubiquitous. But I think from here on out, it's going to be a very commonplace thing on most farms.
His company, Helio, specializes in crop treatment drones.
The drone will go up just like a camera drone, except a lot bigger, right? And instead of just having a camera, these drones have a big tank underneath them for carrying the payload. So they'll go up, and our drones are tuned, and we write the parameters in such a way that it's very smooth flight. So it's not like this thing is taking off like a jet or something. It's hovering and flying over there very calmly to the start point of a spray mission, for example. And then it's just going to start spraying and going along in whatever pattern you told it to spray in. So that could be a lawnmower pattern, or you might be doing the perimeter of a field, or you might just be doing individual points and jumping from point to point to point, so on and so forth. So it's a very smooth, unexciting view, I would say, to be completely honest with you, which is good because if it was exciting, that means that the drone is flying erratically or out of control and you'd be stressed out.
Using these drones gives him a unique understanding of why the laws for such drones are needed.
These are your typical herbicides, pesticides, stuff like that, fungicides. Totally effective and not dangerous if they're used properly. But if you use them improperly, if you're spraying when there's too much wind, if you're spraying into bodies of water that you shouldn't be, for example, then it could create issues. So that's this law that the FAA created is to protect us, the community, from people using these economic poisons improperly. So that's what that whole structure is for.
Drones have a multitude of uses on farms, from spraying to monitoring crop progress and health, and much more. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, while the Cattlemen's Beef Board and the U.S. Department of Agriculture oversee the collection and spending of beef check-all funds, at the beginning of each fiscal year, nonprofit beef organizations present proposals to the CBB to request funding in the program areas. And as Agnet Media's Will Jordan reports, one of those contractors is the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Funding beef promotion, the checkoff is a vital part of ensuring beef is the choice of consumers. National Cattlemen's Beef Association CEO Colin Woodall explains the relationship between the checkoff and his contracting partners.
The checkoff is always under attack, but I think everybody needs to sit back and realize that the checkoff belongs to the producers. The checkoff does not belong to NCBA. And there's a lot of misinformation out there. Cattlemen's Beef Board runs the checkoff, and the Cattlemen's Beef Board is made up of cattle producers. These are cattle producers that are nominated by their states and appointed by the Secretary of Agriculture. They oversee the program to make sure that those dollars are being used correctly. They also evaluate the programs, and ultimately, it's producers who decide where they want to spend that checkoff money. And NCBA is one of the contractors. As a matter of fact, we're one of nine contractors who work on those national dollars. And we have to go and we have to pitch our idea and prove that we can do it. And then the Cattlemen's Beef Board and the Beef Promotion Operating Committee will decide whether or not we get that money. And then we have to show them day in, day out that we're spending that money the way that we said we would, and that's in compliance with the Act and Order.
For more information, visit southeastagnet.com. For Agnet Media, I'm Will Jordan.
Thanks, Will. In other news, the USDA is making investments to increase independent meat and poultry processing capacity, expand market opportunities for farmers, and support a growing workforce in rural areas. USDA is providing some 15 awards totaling $115 million in 17 states and providing another 5 awards totaling $38 million through the Meat and Poultry Processing Expansion Program. The announcement supports projects across the country. These investments will help build a pipeline of well-trained meat processing workers and support safe workspaces and fair wages. And last week, the USDA Marketing Service issued its pork product solicitation as part of its plans for the Section 32 purchase of over $50 million of pork for distribution to various food, nutrition, and assistance programs. Now, the solicitation is to anyone who can sell the required quantities of pork products to the federal government. The solicitation is focused on loins and individual roast. According to the National Pork Producers Council, this is important because the U.S. pork industry is facing a challenging market environment, which has resulted in the worst 7 months of average losses in more than 20 years. Section 32 of the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1935 does authorize the Secretary of Agriculture to make commodity purchases, entitlement purchases, and disaster assistance using funds appropriated annually from the U.S. Customs receipts. So MPPC applauds USDA's purchase and looks forward to continuing to work with the administration to identify additional opportunities. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A chance for farmers to improve viability. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. American Farmland Trust has opened applications for 2023's Brighter Future Fund program. It helps farmers nationwide improve farm viability, access, transfer, or permanently protect farmland, or adopt regenerative agricultural practices. The last day to submit applications is July 15th. The Brighter Future Fund provides grants of up to $10,000 per project. A project may involve one or more individual farmers or farm families, and projects will be awarded on a one-per-farm basis. An AFT news release says, farmers and ranchers work hard to provide for their communities, their families, and their land, but sometimes they need help. The Brighter Future Fund can provide that help. The fund was launched in 2020 to help farmers launch, grow, and sustain farms despite forces impacting the food and agricultural systems, including COVID-19, changing markets, or severe weather. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen. Buy-sell agreements can be very important to assuring a smooth transition of the business from one generation to the next, and they can provide substantial tax savings. But it's important that they be carefully drafted and followed. Next to a properly drafted will or trust, a buy-sell agreement is often an essential part of transitioning the family farming or ranching operation to the next generation. A well-drafted buy-sell agreement is designed to prevent the sale or other transfer of business interests outside the family unit. But they must be drafted carefully and strictly followed. In a recent case, two brothers owned the family business. The corporation owned life insurance on each brother so that if one died, the corporation could use the proceeds to redeem his shares. One brother did die, and the IRS included the value of his stock interest in his estate on the basis that the corporation's fair market value included the life insurance proceeds intended for the stock redemption. That result is contrary to the prevailing court opinion on the issue, which said that corporate value is not increased by the amount of the life insurance death benefit when its purpose is to provide liquidity to the company to redeem a deceased shareholder's interest. The problem in the current case was that the brothers didn't annually certify the value of the corporation or have it appraised, a costly mistake. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
What you are hearing there is the sound of a very busy food bank in Washington, D.C. Food shipments being brought in at all hours, workers sorting and repackaging foods, others preparing foods for donation to needy families and individuals or to other emergency food providers. Food banks and pantries and such all across the country are reporting almost overwhelming demand for food assistance.
In large part because of the ending of the emergency allotments in the SNAP program, families are now looking to food banks, community kitchens, and food pantries for additional assistance and help.
And Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack there says food banks themselves are in need of assistance and help as the cost of food keeps going up along with the need for it. Vilsack told reporters the other day that the U.S. Department of Agriculture is making available about $1 billion of new money to states and territories.
Under our temporary food assistance program, which basically allows us to provide some additional resources to the state so that they in turn can provide help and assistance to food banks, community kitchens, and food pantries.
The money would allow states to buy food commodities from USDA vendors at reduced prices and send those commodities on to food banks and other emergency food providers in those states. But those are not the only organizations in the business of providing food assistance. Some of the biggest providers of food... Yes, you may recognize the sound, school cafeterias, where every school day over 30 million kids receive low or no-cost meals if their schools are among the thousands who participate in the Agriculture Department's school meal programs. Those schools get partial reimbursement for those meals from the Ag Department, and during the COVID emergency, those reimbursements increased to cover the rising costs of food and other food supply chain issues. Now, though, there's no emergency, and reimbursements will be coming back down. But school food managers are still seeing food prices and labor costs going up.
And the result is they are expressing concerns about how they're going to meet the needs of the millions of children who will start school later this summer.
Vilsack said his department is jumping in to help.
We're announcing today $1.3 billion of assistance and help distributed to states through a formula process to supply schools with necessary support and help to get them through a difficult time.
The money will be used by schools to buy domestically produced food commodities for use in school meals. So Vilsack says the nation's emergency food providers and school food managers are getting some much-needed help.
And we're hopeful that this assistance and help will make it easier for folks to meet the demand that is out there today.
In Washington, Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water. Your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Bottom line, grain analysts say the volatility in the grain trade is going to be the rule the next 30 days. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report to end the week, brought to you by Helena Agri. Minor yield changes from here will have major price impacts, according to our bottom line analysts, especially in soybeans. But that being said, recent weather systems, they say, can stabilize and even improve soybean ending yields, and we see sellers having the upper hand from here. November contract high, 1428, but with weather systems and the absence of 100-degree heat, we doubt November will get back to that level. In fact, needs to hold 1335 or better today. If December corn can close above 505, that would be a sign support is building in corn. And we haven't lost track of the rebound in wheat. Kansas City continues to expand the spread with Chicago. Slow harvest, quality concerns being talked about with heavy rains in Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma. September, Kansas City, a close the day above 860 would be very positive. This is the Bottom Line Report. Join Helena in Memphis, Tennessee, July 18th for the Innovation Expo. Hear about all the new technology for your crops. Contact your Helena rep for BIP tickets. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
Inspections to ensure quality products. The California Department of Food and Agriculture's Shipping Point Inspection Program inspected 3.81 billion pounds of fresh produce in the fiscal year 2021 and 2022. The inspectors look at produce to make sure that it meets the industry-developed standards, such as U.S. grade standards or other written government or private specifications for fresh products. This inspection is different than testing for pesticides, as the inspectors can certify that California produce commodities are quality grade to condition, size, net weight, temperature, and other factors required by the user and end consumer. Inspections can happen in the field, in packing houses, or at storage facilities. Last year, the inspections included roughly 614 million pounds of almonds, 598 million pounds of tomatoes, 400 million pounds of table grapes, 90 million pounds of cherries, and 83 million pounds of kiwis. For more information, visit cdfa.ca.gov and search Shipping Point Inspections.
Fertilizer prices continue heading lower. Rabobank says a bearish sentiment in the global markets continues driving fertilizer prices lower after an extended run of significantly higher costs. Samuel Taylor is the executive director of farm input research for Rabobank and says fertilizer prices have seen quite a turnaround.
Affordability of fertilizers has basically inverted in a year, going from one of the most unaffordable periods in a cycle, and a cycle being a long cycle, a multi-decadal cycle, to one of the more affordable. And so you've basically seen strong underlying commodity prices, corn, soybean, relative to what we were necessarily used to in previous low cycles. And you've seen fertilizer prices come off their high that we saw immediately after the start of the Russia-Ukraine crisis.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
3 years of USMCA. July 1st was the third anniversary of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement going into effect, and the U.S. pork industry is happy to celebrate the occasion. Pork exports to America's neighbors, especially Mexico, have soared under the successor to the North America Free Trade Agreement. Since USMCA took effect, U.S. pork exports to Mexico have increased from almost $1.2 billion in 2020 to more than $2 billion last year. Exports to Canada have grown from about $853 million in 2020 to $867 million in 2022. For the first 4 months of this year, both countries are on pace to take in record amounts of American pork during 2023. Exports to Mexico and Canada totaled nearly $3 billion, accounting for 38% of all U.S. pork exports in 2022, and it supported more than 16,000 jobs. The USMCA maintained the zero tariff rate on pork traded in North America, which was first established under NAFTA. An AFP contributed to that report.
The results are in for the recent general sign-up of USDA's Conservation Reserve Program. Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Ducheneau says the acreage enrollment number is
just over 1 million acres. I think the number is 1.018 million acres.
The breakdown includes 295,000 newly enrolled acres nationwide through the general CRP sign-up, plus re-enrollment of 891,000 acres with expiring CRP contracts. The administrator reminds us that the General Conservation Reserve Program acreage enrollment is not the only voluntary CRP sign-up taking place in 2023. For starters,
grassland sign-up closed at the end of May,
with final numbers being tallied for this working lands program that allows landowners to continue haying and grazing while conserving grasslands through various practices.
There is continuous CRP, and that's probably the most vulnerable lands that we have with regard to environmental sensitivities. And producers can come in and enroll those acres at any time. It's a continuous enrollment opportunity.
And with the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, CREP,
we have, I think, dozens of program agreements across the country with states and NGOs, and interest in that has really taken off since the changes in the 2018 Farm Bill that allow for those partner organizations in this public-private partnership to come to the table, bring in-kind resources to bear in the form of compliance or technical assistance, and really target local resource concerns based on what their stakeholders have identified as the needs.
The 2018 Farm Bill set a cap of 27 million acres for total CRP enrollment. And with the latest general sign-up,
we are going to be right at about 24 million with continuous sign-up going on and with some substantial acreages of opportunity in our CREP agreements out there in Indian Country and beyond.
More details about CRP are available at local FSA offices or online at farmers.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Today we have another part of my conversation with Stanislaus County Farm Bureau's Anna Genesi and grower and applicator Jennifer Dickey from Stanislaus County. We're continuing our conversation on the sustainable roadmap for California, as well as getting an update on the statewide pesticide notification pilot program that Stanislaus County was a part of. And as far as like being transparent goes and the consumer really wanting to be notified on what is on my crop or when are you spraying, we recently talked about the pilot notification program that Stanislaus County has been a part of. It's a statewide program that is hoping to be implemented, and you guys are sort of in the testing process along with other counties. What's going on with that? Can you give me an update on if it's working, some of the concerns that you had with it? Just a quick update.
Yeah, thanks, Danielle. So from a compliance perspective, and I appreciated what Stanislaus County did with that pilot program. It required that you, anyone who was interested in obtaining the information, had to create a login. Right. So you didn't just get to be anonymous. And I know that we've seen, you know, with social media and whatnot, these, you know, people get awfully bold when there's no, you know, you have no skin in the game. Right. You don't have to say who you are. And so one of the things about the Stanislaus program that I appreciated was you had to create like a login. Right. The other piece that they did, is it didn't zero in on, you know, who the applicator was, or exactly where the application was taking place. Because the flip side of this coin is, I don't want Jen and her crew out doing a bloom spray to then have somebody show up in the field because they figured out through this notification system that there's spray work and they're going in there, you know, to purposely get drifted on so that they can cause a case. Right. And there might be people listening to me right now thinking, oh, come on, Anna, that's extreme. It's not. We have gotten information about people like literally going through orchards with air monitors so that they can show exceedances.
Wow.
Right. So it's you're always going to have people on this spectrum of no pesticide use, like the extremes. Right. And I don't, and I think in general, the majority of the folks are not on those, you know, dynamic ends of the spectrum. We're probably more close to the middle than we actually think. So there were things built into that system that I really appreciate. Now in May, just this last May, I had the opportunity to sit in on a Zoom call with DPR as they were showing a demo, for lack of a better word, of what this statewide notification system could look like. And right now, DPR's goal is for it to be fully operational 2024.
Wow.
Yeah. I know. And like, here we are, gang, sitting in June.
I feel like that doesn't even give you guys enough time to report all of your findings and to say, hey, look, we got to adjust some of these things.
Yeah.
Right. And it doesn't
give
enough
time. Implemented next year.
It doesn't give enough time to notify growers. I was telling Anna before this interview that we were sitting at the Nut Festival or the Nut Symposium or whatever that was at Stanislaus County Fairgrounds not very long ago. And one of the commissioners just briefed right over it and my ears perked up. I was like, wait, what? What did she just say? County, what? Wait a minute, hold on. So I asked some questions and people are talking in the area, like and I'm like, hey, you guys need to listen to this. Like, so what does that mean for us? What is this? And when she started to explain it and she just didn't just like skim over the top of it and she said what it meant and what we were going to have to do, the place was in an uproar. It was like, wait a minute, what? Like they didn't even know it was coming. And if I hadn't like caught a couple of the words and went, wait a minute, this does not make any sense. It's atrocious. Like it's incredibly invasive in my opinion as a grower. And like Anna said, I do custom work. So if I have to notify when I am in every location, like I said, farmers want to have pollinators succeed, soil succeed. Like we want, so we spray, we go what I call nocturnal. When it comes time to bloop time, my guys and I, we work from 5-6 o'clock at night when the sun starts to go down, so 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, because we want the bees to be asleep. And it's amazing how many people are out there in the middle of the night doing weird things, right? And so if you have to start to notify these people and you have to, we have one block that we spray that, is right along a canal bank, and it's super populated by walkers in the area. And we know this. And it says on the canal bank, the irrigation district has put up permanent signs that say, do not walk here, agriculture area. Do not walk on this side of the canal. Those signs are there. I put T-posts along the canal with caution tape and a sign that says spraying, walk on the other side of the canal. One morning at 2 a.m., I'm out there. I put my T-posts up. I put my caution tape up, and I'm walking down the canal bank, and my dog starts to bark. And I'm like, what the heck? And this guy goes, your dog's supposed to be on a leash. And I said, you just went under caution tape. You're not even supposed to be here. Like, they just don't get it. So you're giving information about, like Anna brought up, like these labels. I have to train my employees for hours on how to read these labels, what they mean, what the information means, what their protective equipment means. And I have to spend that time with every single one of my employees every year. And we go over hundreds, and I mean hundreds of labels every year, hours, 2 to 3 days of training, because it's important. The Joe Blow is not going to get that. They're going to read this and go, danger chemical. Oh my gosh, the sky is falling. The sky is falling. You know, like it's they're not going to have the training. They're not going to have the information. They're not going to, they're going to not be educated on actually what they're reading.
Well, right. Danielle, I think Jen, like it just hits, you know, it right on the tail there. Cause the demo, it's very clear to me. And obviously I have empathy for growers that they did not take our input as seriously as I would have hoped. One win for us is it does look like they are only requiring notification for California restricted materials. So that's a win. So that'll work within the NOI notice of intent system that we currently have. So it won't be an additional piece of paperwork for farmers, ranchers, and dairymen. So I will take that as a win. My biggest concern is there is no requirement to identify who you are. You can be in another country and access information specific to Stanislaus County down to 1 square mile. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out who the owner of a piece of property is. And so there is a real concern that this tool, while it means to provide education for people who live in areas around where pesticides are being used, there is a real concern that it's essentially going to become a database for attorneys to sue. And so the other thing that gives me heartburn, in addition to being able to zoom into 1 square mile, when I click on the dot or whatever it was that denotes the pesticide application, it does link you to the label. And to Jen's point, pesticide labels are written for pesticide handlers. So those people who are mixing, loading, applying pesticides, and for field workers. And the definition of field workers are people who are working in an area where pesticides have been used within the last 30 days. So these handlers and field workers, right, these are folks that there is opportunity for exposure if you don't follow the rules. And it's why Jen spends 2 to 3 days covering those safety rules with her team. My concern is if Joe homeowner who lives within that mile of the application reads that label, he or she is going to think that those same safety precautions apply to them. And they don't. The rule, I mean, there's not rules yet, but there isn't really even information out there. Because I asked DPR in this demo, I'm like, hey, are there guidelines? You know, if I'm the neighbor, right, and I get that, I get a notification that there's going to be a pesticide application. Do I bring little Johnny in from the front yard? Do I close my windows? Do I make him rinse his bike off with water before I let him touch the handlebars again? I don't know, because they're not providing that information. And so I, like Jen, I'm concerned that it's either going to A, cause hysteria because we're not providing the correct, accurate information, or B, it's going to become like a Prop 65 thing where we just don't pay attention to it anymore. And either route defeats the purpose of the notification. I feel like they're rushing this. In my personal opinion, I feel like they're rushing this.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The Department of Viticulture and Enology at UC Davis will be hosting a harvest readiness webinar in the coming weeks. The webinar will begin at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, July 18th. Viticulture research scientist Brent Sams will begin the event with a presentation on spatial variability in yield and fruit quality. That will be followed up by information about key grape measurements and other things to think about. Viticulture and Enology Professor David Block will be presenting information on successful fermentation management. The Zoom webinar will also feature a presentation on yeast and yeast choices from Nicola Hall, Technical Director of Fermentation and Enology at Scott Labs. The event will conclude with a presentation on what to do when grapes are exposed to smoke from Vice Chair and Professor of Cooperative Extension and Enology, Anita Oberholster. More information about the webinar is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.